Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. Now I'd like to start another angle on debt, investigating it from a different perspective and focusing on how there have been programs and systems to actually generate debt on a global level for the benefit of corporations and governments. I'm going to go into a New York Times bestseller by John Perkins, his first book called Confessions of an Economic Hitman. In the riveting story of Confessions of an Economic Hitman, John Perkins tells his own inner journey from willing servant of empire to impassioned advocate for the rights of oppressed people. Covertly recruited by the United States National Security Agency and on the payroll of an international consulting firm, he traveled the world to Indonesia, Panama, Ecuador, Colombia, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and other strategically important countries. His job was to implement policies that promoted the interests of the U.S. corporatocracy, which is a coalition of government, banks, and corporations, while professing to alleviate poverty, policies that alienated many nations and ultimately led to September 11th and growing anti-Americanism. Perkins' story illuminates just how far he and his colleagues, self-described as economic hitmen, were willing to go. He explains, for instance, how he helped to implement a secret scheme that funneled billions of Saudi Arabian petrodollars back into the U.S. economy and that further cemented the intimate relationship between the Islamic fundamentalist House of Saud and a succession of American administrations. Perkins reveals the hidden mechanics of imperial control behind some of the most dramatic events in recent history, such as the fall of the Shah of Iran, the death of Panamanian President Omar Torrijos, and the U.S. invasions of Panama and Iraq. By the way, this book was published in 2004. The book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which many people warned Perkins not to write, exposes the little-known inner workings of a system that fosters globalization and leads to the impoverishment of millions of people across the planet. It is a compelling story that also offers hope and a vision for realizing the American dream of a just and compassionate world that will bring us greater security. And I highly recommend that anyone who finds what I'm going to go through interesting should go and get the book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins. So first, let's define this. And this is a quote from John Perkins. Economic hitmen, EHMs, are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. They funnel money from the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, and other foreign aid organizations into the coffers of huge corporations and the pockets of a few wealthy families who control the planet's natural resources. Their tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. They play a game as old as empire, but one that has taken on new and terrifying dimensions during this time of globalization. I should know. I was an EHM. End quote. Again, that's John Perkins. And I will continue where I left off in the last show from Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which I highly recommend that you read. John came to understand that life is composed of a series of coincidences. How one reacts to these, how one exercises what some refer to as free will, is everything. The choices one makes within the boundaries of the twists of fate determine who we are. Two major coincidences that shaped his life occurred at Middlebury. One came in the form of an Iranian, the son of a general, who was a personal advisor to the Shah. The other was a beautiful young woman named Anne, like his childhood sweetheart. The first, whom he calls Farad, had played professional soccer in Rome. He was endowed with an athletic physique, curly black hair, soft walnut eyes, and a background and charisma that made him irresistible to women. He was John's opposite in many ways. John worked hard to win his friendship, and he taught John many things that would serve him well in the years to come. John also met Anne. Although she was seriously dating a young man who attended another college, she took John under her wing. Their platonic relationship was the first truly loving one he had ever experienced. Farad encouraged John to drink, party, and ignore his parents. He consciously chose to stop studying. He decided he would break his academic leg to get even with his father. John's grades plummeted. He lost his scholarship. Halfway through his sophomore year, he elected to drop out. His father threatened to disown him. Farad egged him on. John stormed into the dean's office and quit school. It was a pivotal moment in his life. Farad and he celebrated his last night in town together at a local bar. A drunken farmer, a giant of a man, accused John of flirting with his wife, picked him up off his feet, and hurled him against a wall. Farad stepped between them, drew a knife, and slashed the farmer open at the cheek. Then he dragged John across the room and shoved him through a window, out onto a ledge high above Otter Creek. They jumped and made their way along the river and back to their dorm. The next morning, when interrogated by campus police, John lied and refused to admit any knowledge of the incident. Nevertheless, Farad was expelled. They both moved to Boston and shared an apartment there. John landed a job at Hearst's Record American Sunday Advertiser newspapers as a personal assistant to the editor-in-chief of the Sunday Advertiser. Later that year, 1965, several of John's friends at the newspaper were drafted. To avoid a similar fate, he entered Boston University's College of Business Administration. By then, Anne had broken up with her old boyfriend, and she often traveled down from Middlebury to visit. He welcomed her attention. She graduated in 1967, while he still had another year to complete at BU. She adamantly refused to move in with him until they were married. Although he joked about being blackmailed, and in fact did resent what he saw as a continuation of his parents' archaic and prudish set of moral standards, he enjoyed their times together and wanted more. They married. Anne's father, a brilliant engineer, had masterminded the navigational system for an important class of missile and was rewarded with a high-level position in the Department of the Navy. His best friend, a man Anne called Uncle Frank, not his real name, was employed as an executive at the highest echelons of the National Security Agency, NSA, the country's least known and by most accounts largest spy organization. And I will continue in a moment. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Shortly after Anne and John's marriage, the military summoned him for his physical. He passed and therefore faced the prospect of Vietnam upon graduation. The idea of fighting in Southeast Asia tore him apart emotionally, though war had always fascinated him. He was raised on tales about his colonial ancestors, who included Thomas Paine and Ethan Allen, and he had visited all the New England and upstate New York battle sites of both the French and Indian and the Revolutionary Wars. He read every historical novel he could find. In fact, when Army Special Forces units first encountered Southeast Asia, he was eager to sign up. But as the media exposed the atrocities and the inconsistencies of U.S. policy, he experienced a change of heart. He found himself wondering whose side Paine would have taken. He was sure he would have joined the Viet Cong enemies. Uncle Frank came to his rescue. He informed John that an NSA job made one eligible for draft deferment, and he arranged for a series of meetings at his agency, including a day of grueling polygraph-monitored interviews. He was told that these tests would determine whether he was suitable material for NSA recruitment and training, and if he was, would provide a profile of his strengths and weaknesses, which would be used to map out his career. Given his attitude toward the Vietnam War, John was convinced he would fail the tests. Under examination, he admitted that as a loyal American, he opposed the war, and he was surprised when the interviewers did not pursue this subject. Instead, they focused on his upbringing, his attitude toward his parents, the emotions generated by the fact he grew up as a poor Puritan among so many wealthy hedonistic preppies. They also explored his frustration about the lack of women, sex, and money in his life, and the fantasy world that had evolved as a result. He was amazed by the attention they gave to his relationship with Farad, and by their interest in his willingness to lie to the campus police to protect him. At first, John assumed all these things that seemed so negative to him marked him as an NSA reject, but the interviews continued, suggesting otherwise. It was not until several years later that he realized that, from an NSA viewpoint, these negatives actually were positive. Their assessment had less to do with issues of loyalty to his country than with the frustrations of his life. Anger at his parents, an obsession with women, and his ambition to live the good life gave them a hook. John was seducible. His determination to excel in school and in sports, his ultimate rebellion against his father, his ability to get along with foreigners, and his willingness to lie to the police were exactly the types of attributes they sought. He also discovered later that Farad's father worked for the U.S. intelligence community in Iran. His friendship with Farad was therefore a definite plus. A few weeks after the NSA testing, he was offered a job to start training in the art of spying, to begin after he received his degree from BU several months later. However, before he had officially accepted this offer, he impulsively attended a seminar given at BU by a Peace Corps recruiter. A major selling point was that, like the NSA, Peace Corps jobs made one eligible for draft deferments. The decision to sit in on that seminar was one of those coincidences that seemed insignificant at the time, but turned out to have life-changing implications. The recruiter described several places in the world that needed volunteers. One of these was the Amazon rainforest, where, he pointed out, indigenous people lived very much as natives of North America had until the arrival of Europeans. John had always dreamed of living like the Abnakis who inhabited New Hampshire when his ancestors first settled there. He knew he had Abnaki blood in his veins, and he wanted to learn the type of forest lore they understood so well. He approached the recruiter after his talk and asked about the possibility of being assigned to the Amazon. He assured there was a great need for volunteers in that region and that his chances would be excellent. He called Uncle Frank. To his surprise, Uncle Frank encouraged him to consider the Peace Corps. His uncle confided that after the fall of Hanoi, which in those days was deemed a certainty by men in his position, the Amazon would become a hot spot. Loaded with oil, he said. We'll need good agents there, people who understand the natives. His uncle assured him that the Peace Corps would be an excellent training ground and urged him to become proficient in Spanish as well as in local indigenous dialects. You might, he chuckled, end up working for a private company instead of the government. John did not understand what his uncle meant by that at the time. He was being upgraded from a spy to EHM, that is, an economic hitman, although he had never heard the term and would not for a few more years. He had no idea that there were hundreds of men and women scattered around the world, working for consulting firms and other private companies, people who never received a penny of salary from any government agency and yet were serving the interests of the empire. Nor could he have guessed that a new type, with more euphemistic titles, would number in the thousands by the end of the millennium, and that he would play a significant role in shaping this growing army. Anne and John applied to the Peace Corps and requested an assignment in the Amazon. When their acceptance notification arrived, his first reaction was one of extreme disappointment. The letter stated that they would be sent to Ecuador. John was confused. He requested the Amazon and thought this was Africa. He went to an atlas and looked up Ecuador. He was dismayed when he could not find it anywhere on the African continent. In the index, though, he discovered that it is indeed located in Latin America, and he saw on the map that the river systems flowing off its Andean glaciers from the headwaters to the Amazon. Further reading assured him that Ecuador's jungles were some of the most diverse and formidable in the world, and that the indigenous people still lived much as they had for millennia. They accepted. Anne and John completed the Peace Corps training in Southern California and headed for Ecuador in September of 1968. They lived in the Amazon with the Shuar, whose lifestyle did indeed resemble that of pre-colonial North American natives. They also worked in the Andes with descendants of the Incas. It was a side of the world he had never dreamed still existed. Until then, the only Latin Americans he had met were the wealthy preppies at the school where his father taught. He found himself sympathizing with these indigenous people who subsisted on hunting and farming. He felt an odd sort of kinship with them. Somehow, they reminded him of the townies he had left behind. One day, a man in a business suit, Einar Greve, landed at the airstrip in their community. He was vice president of Chase T. Maine, Inc., Maine, an international consulting firm that kept a very low profile and that was in charge of studies to determine whether the World Bank should lend Ecuador and its neighboring countries billions of dollars to build hydroelectric dams and other infrastructure projects. Einar also was a colonel in the U.S. Army Reserve. Einar started talking with John about the benefits of working for a company like Maine. When John mentioned that he had been accepted by the NSA before joining the Peace Corps and that he was considering going back to them, Einar informed him that he sometimes acted as an NSA liaison. Einar gave John a look that made John suspect that part of his assignment was to evaluate John's capabilities. He believes that he was updating John's profile and especially sizing up John's abilities to survive in environments most North Americans would find hostile. And I'll return to this in a moment. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you're listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. John and Einar spent a couple of days in Ecuador and afterward communicated by mail. Einar asked him to send reports assessing Ecuador's economic prospects. John had a small portable typewriter, loved to write, and was quite happy to comply with this request. Over a period of about a year, he sent Einar at least 15 long letters, In these letters, he speculated on Ecuador's economic and political future, and he appraised the growing frustration about the indigenous communities as they struggled to confront oil companies, international development agencies, and other attempts to draw them into the modern world. When John's Peace Corps tour was over, Einar invited him to a job interview at Maine headquarters in Boston. During their private meeting, Einar emphasized that Maine's primary business was engineering, but that their biggest client, the World Bank, recently had begun insisting that they keep economists on the staff to produce the critical economic forecasts used to determine the feasibility and magnitude of engineering projects. Einar confided that he had previously hired three highly qualified economists with impeccable credentials, two with master's degrees and one with a PhD, but they had failed miserably. None of them, Einar said, can handle the idea of producing economic forecasts in countries where reliable statistics aren't available. He went on to tell John that, in addition, all of them had found it impossible to fulfill the terms of their contracts, which required them to travel to remote places in countries like Ecuador, Indonesia, Iran, and Egypt to interview local leaders and to provide personal assessments about the prospects for economic development in those regions. One had actually suffered a nervous breakdown in an isolated Panamanian village. He was escorted by Panamanian police to the airport and put on a plane back to the United States. The letters you sent me indicate that you don't mind sticking your neck out even when hard data isn't available. And given your living conditions in Ecuador, I'm confident you can survive almost anywhere. Einar told John that he already had fired one of those economists and was prepared to do the same with the other two if John accepted the job. So it was in January 1971, John was offered a position as an economist with Maine. He had turned 26, the magical age when the draft board no longer wanted him. He consulted with Anne's family. They encouraged him to take the job, and he assumed this reflected Uncle Frank's attitude as well. He recalled Uncle Frank mentioning the possibility he would end up working for a private firm. Nothing was ever stated openly, but John had no doubt that his employment at Maine was a consequence of the arrangements Uncle Frank had made 3 years earlier. In addition to his experiences in Ecuador and his willingness to write about the country's economic and political situation, John's head reeled for several weeks, and he had a very swollen ego. He had earned only a bachelor's degree from BU, which did not seem to warrant a position as an economist with such a lofty consulting company. He knew that many of his BU classmates who had been rejected by the draft and had gone on to earn MBAs and other graduate degrees would be overcome with jealousy. He visualized himself as a dashing secret agent heading off to exotic lands, lounging beside hotel swimming pools surrounded by gorgeous bikini-clad women, martini in hand. Although this was merely fantasy, he would discover that it held elements of truth. Einar had hired him as an economist, but he would soon learn that his real job went far beyond that, and that it was in fact closer to James Bond's than he could have ever guessed. In legal parlance, Maine would be called a closely held corporation. Roughly 5% of its 2,000 employees owned the company. These were referred to as partners or associates, and their position was coveted. Not only did the partners have power over everyone else, but also they made the big bucks. Discretion was their hallmark. They dealt with heads of state and other chief executive officers who expect their consultants, like their attorneys and psychotherapists, to honor a strict code of absolute confidentiality. Talking with the press was taboo. It simply was not tolerated. As a consequence, hardly anyone outside Maine had ever heard of them, although many were familiar with their competitors, such as Arthur D. Little, Stone & Weber, Brown & Root, Halliburton, and Bechtel. John uses the term competitors loosely because, in fact, Maine was in a league by itself. The majority of their professional staff was engineers, yet they owned no equipment and never constructed so much as a storage shed. Many Mainers were ex-military. However, they did not contract with the Department of Defense or with any of the military services. Their stock and trade was something so different from the norm that during his first months there, even he could not figure out what the company did. He only knew that his first real assignment would be in Indonesia and that he would be part of an 11-man team sent to create a master energy plan for the island of Java. John also knew that Einar and others who discussed the job with him were eager to convince John that Java's economy would boom and that if he wanted to distinguish himself as a good forecaster and therefore be offered promotions, he would produce projections that demonstrated as much. Right off the chart, Einar liked to say. He would glide his fingers through the air and up over his head, an economy that will soar like a bird. Einar took frequent trips that usually lasted only 2 to 3 days. No one talked much about them or seemed to know where he had gone. When he was in the office, he often invited John to sit with him for a few minutes over coffee. Einar asked about Anne, their new apartment, and the cat they had brought with them from Ecuador. John grew bolder as he came to know Einar better, and he tried to learn more about him and what he would be expected to do in his job. But John never received answers that satisfied him. Einar was a master at turning conversations around. On one such occasion, Einar gave John a peculiar look. "You needn't worry," Einar said. "We have high expectations for you. I was in Washington recently." His voice trailed off and he smiled inscrutably. "In any case, you know, we have a big project in Kuwait. It'll be a while before you leave for Indonesia. I think you should use some of your time to read up on Kuwait. The Boston Public Library is a great resource, and we can get you passes to the MIT and Harvard libraries." After that, John spent many hours in those libraries, especially in the BPL, which was located a few blocks away from the office and very close to his Back Bay apartment. John became familiar with Kuwait, as well as with many books on economic statistics published by the United Nations, the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, and the World Bank. He knew that he would be expected to produce econometric models for Indonesia and Java, and he decided that he might as well get started by doing one for Kuwait. However, his BS in business administration had not prepared him as an econometrician, so he spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to go about it. He went so far as to enroll in a couple of courses on the subject. In the process, he discovered that statistics can be manipulated to produce a large array of conclusions, including those substantiating the predilections of the analyst. Now, Maine was a macho corporation. There were only 4 women who held professional positions in 1971. However, there were perhaps 200 women divided between the cadres of personal, secretaries, every vice president and department manager had one, and the steno pool, which served the rest of the men. John had become accustomed to this gender bias and was therefore especially astounded by what happened one day in the BPL's reference section. And I will continue the story in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.